Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak up. Kōrerotia. Tune in as our guests speak up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right.
Kia ora, ko Speak Up kōrero tia tēnei, ko Sale Carlton aho. Te kōpapa o tura ko free speech. So free speeches are going to be our kōpapa for today's kōrero on Speak Up kōrero tia. And this is a bit of a companion show to last month's show, which looked at the right to protest. So today we're thinking about free speech, freedom of expression, and we've got three guests who are going to lead us through the intricacies of quite a complex and a somewhat controversial issue. I would love to hear from each of you a bit more about yourselves, ko wai koe, and also where is it or why is it you've come to this kind of work? What draws you to this topic? We've got Ursula Chia back on the show. It's really lovely to have you back. How about we hear from you?
Kia ora, Sally. Thank you so much. Ko Ursula Chia, toku ingoa. Yeah, I'm a professor at the University of Canterbury, and I've been at Canterbury over 30 years now. In that time, I've increasingly developed specialism in media law, and a part of that is freedom of expression and the clash between freedom of expression and other rights that people should have and how the law copes with that tension. It's really enjoyable, and it also very much changing, especially with increasing changes in technology these days.
I suspect that we'll talk quite a bit about technology as we go through this show. Yeah.
Sure.
And another University of Canterbury colleague and another former guest on the show, Mike Grimshaw.
Kia ora, everyone. Mike Grimshaw. I'm Associate Professor of Sociology at University of Canterbury. I also work across areas of New Zealand history, history of ideas, religion, culture. And I got interested in free speech when I was thinking about the role of free speech in society, but also the history of free speech, the ways in which, especially in New Zealand history, we've had times when we've moved against free speech in the university, we've moved against free speech in society. And then more recently, I got involved in writing and thinking about such questions and talking with, for, and against the Free Speech Union in various ways at events. Dane got me involved and being involved in those questions about where does free speech sit in regard to, say, academic freedom? What are rights and responsibilities of free speech? How might we think about free speech in society? And if we are moving against free speech, then what are the situations that might eventuate? In a sense, what are we giving up if we are seeking to limit free speech? But also, who makes the decisions? So I'm a sociologist, but I'm really just a mongrel. I look at everything, intellectual mongrel, look across a whole lot of things and write across a whole lot of things, and everything's society. So that's what I'm interested in.
Thank you very much, Mike. And Dane from the Free Speech Union. And it'd be great to hear about you, but also about what is the Free Speech Union.
Kia ora, everyone. My name is Dane Giroux. In my day job, I'm a screenwriter and a documentarian writer primarily. So I've written a lot of comedies too. So I've got experience as a comedy writer, and we're often pushing the line and trying to sort of go as far as we can go in terms of free speech. Often we're pulled back, but it's always about trying to go as far as we can go and to create a new space, really. We're always looking to create new space. I think even documentarians and screenwriting too, I think that every project I probably do, I'm trying to create more space for more speech. It just tends to be what happens in the arts. Not a question that comes up too often attached to the arts, but I think that is what we are really trying to do when we create art, is create more speech and more conversation. I am on the board of the Free Speech Union. I've been on the board for quite a while now. I took a year off at one point. I always had an interest in free speech. I'm in the Jewish community, so as a minority, I value free speech very strongly. And I also come from South Auckland. I was raised in South Auckland in a very working class, poor neighborhood, Otahuhu. And it's interesting because we often get attacked as being far right, being the free speech union. But the advocacy that I've been doing for years has pushed me way further left, where I've seen sort of patterns and everything and been reminded of my upbringing a lot, actually, and the kind of people that tend to get silenced and the kind of people that really do value their voices. So that's who I am. And that's a bit about my background. Yeah.
Kia ora.
I just want to build on something Dane said, which is, I mean, coming from that left working class background, because the history of free speech in New Zealand comes out of civil liberties on one level. So we had academic freedom, and that was always an academic freedom, especially for those articulating more of a left articulation of society and critique, people like John Beaglehole, who became one of the great New Zealand historians. But in the 1930s, he was not allowed to be given a position at Auckland University because he was seen as too radical in supporting the left wing in the university. In the 1950s, civil liberties in New Zealand arose because of support down here at Canterbury. There was Wolfie Rosenberg, famous figure on the left in New Zealand, Arthur Pryor, another one who was very important, and they articulated the Civil Liberties Union to argue for the rights to protest, to articulate dissenting opinions against the government of the day from a left perspective. And I think that's what's interested me with my engagement with the Free Speech Union is it's actually far more varied when you're there on the inside talking with people than it's often seen on the outside. Yes, it's a broad spectrum, but sometimes the loudest voices are not the ones who are representative of other people as well. So there's a really important thing I think that we need to remember is that free speech belongs to no one on a political framework. And when one side tries to claim free speech against another, then it's what I call frame speech. We want free speech for myself, but we don't want free speech for others.
Yeah.
And how we get that is one of the big questions.
I'm glad you've made that point, Mike. But I'm constantly sort of noting the irony of minority groups very keen to have freedom of expression, but not kind of realizing the irony in suggesting that they should have that by limiting or removing the free speech of others. It's a difficult and complex issue, but that to me is very marked that happens.
Yeah.
I think we're probably already seeing some of the complexity. We've touched on politics, we've touched on society, we've touched on legislation. So all of this is kind of in the mix here as we're thinking about what is free speech. And I'll leave that up to you guys because it could be a big question or maybe it's quite small. What do you think?
What is free speech? For me, it's a very simple principle, really. It's just the idea that, well, I mean, I would call it radical democracy. The ability for everyone to speak their mind, even the vile ideas. And the interesting thing about free speech, and people don't often like hearing this, is that clearly it wants your worst ideas. It wants to draw everything out of you, even the putrid stuff, put it all on the table, and it wants society to look at what's there and say, nope, we're throwing this ugly thing back in the sea. We don't want it. You know, so it is a way of making everyone feel that they can participate, which I think is a really important element to this. And then we're able to look at all the ideas, assess them, and decide whether it works for us or it doesn't. My concern about the pushback to free speech now, which seems to be coming from the organized mainstream left in many ways, even though, as you see in the Trump administration, as soon as they get in, he's got all sorts of censorship agendas and pressures and bullying that's going on. So basically, whoever holds the power tends to want to silence other people because they can. They can at that point, you know? Yeah, my concern with it is that it's just the whole participation in society aspect to it, and what happens when you deny people that participation in various levels. if there are issues that people feel they cannot speak about, do they shrug their shoulders and get a new hobby? I think the immigration debate in the UK and some of these very tricky and uncomfortable issues prove that that's not what happens. Resentment grows and speech finds a way. And if we can't do it through discussion, what is that third way? It's often quite ugly. So for me, and this is speaking as a minority now, I don't think the censorship we've seen, say, in Australia, associated with the what happened after the Bondi tragedy and Israel-Palestine, I don't feel like our community is any safer. Like, I'm on X and reading a lot of Australian accounts, and they're squarely blaming the Jewish community for limiting their democracy. I don't know how that makes us safer when that sort of narrative is out there. So for me, free speech is about the marketplace of ideas, but it's about participation. That's what I would say, radical democracy and participation. And we've got to be very careful when we deny anyone in the society full participation.
So is that a question, Dane, about rights and responsibilities? Is there reciprocity here? Because everyone wants to be able to articulate free speech, but that responsibility is then how do we respond to it? And so what we have is sort of the splurt out onto the table of the public square. What do we do in response to that? Well, we don't tend to have that second response. I don't know if you've seen that, Ursula, as well, whether you work on media law, people want to say something, but then where's that next stage of the discussion of ideas, the assessment, the engagement, the critique? And who is to undertake that, and how is that to be facilitated is perhaps one of the big questions that we've actually got, because everyone wants to say something, but then nobody wants to listen.
That's great, Mike, because being a lawyer, I tend to look for sort of legal sources. I mean, I grew up in a house where freedom of expression and freedom of expression theory was really hugely valued, and I knew about that million theory that Dane has just described from a very young age. And I revered it, and that led to my work first in censorship for my master's in the UK, and now since through right into media law. But of course, the million theory, you can't forget the harm aspect of that. And that's where the tension is in this theory. You know, we've all got the right and indeed the need to live our lives, live the best lives that we can live and as freely as we can without interference from the government and so on, including freedom of expression, but only to the point that we don't harm others. And that's the weakness in this abstract theory, which about, you know, we can spend a lot of time arguing about what is harm, what is the harm. But to me, I've been able to kind of reconcile it in terms of law by looking at, we've got freedom of expression in the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act, and it describes it as everyone having the right to freedom of expression, including freedom to seek, receive, and impart information and opinions of any kind in any form. And a lot of people ignore that first part about seeking and receiving, and that's the listening part of it, as you say. And most people focus on the speaking, the publishing, you know, being able to say or publish whatever you like. But the point is, the Bill of Rights Act encompasses this. It's always been the harm principle limits. I'm afraid everyone assumes freedom of expression is unlimited. It might be in the US. It isn't here. It is limited by the point at which you begin to harm others by your published speech. And a lot of my career has been around looking at those other areas that where we can argue that society and government for the people have recognised that there are harms that need to be protected against in terms of published speech, and so there are limitations. And wherever they clash, yes, you have to be extremely careful. If you're going to limit speech, it has to be proportionate to the harm that you're worried about. That's a continuing sort of negotiation that has to go on, not only for judges, but anyone who's involved in free speech activities and making use of free speech. To me, free speech is the primary right. Without free speech, the other rights are often negated and unable to be exercised. And that's why it's really important. You might be a minority group, but if you can't speak about that, then you're in a lot of trouble and things won't improve for you. So to me, freedom of expression, it's indeed a fundamental right, but it can be limited in a proportionate way to harms within recognised as such by the state, by the people, sufficient people to say that this should operate. But of course, negotiating all that on the ground level where there's a protest going on or someone wants to speak and someone's objecting to that and so on, it's a lot more difficult than it looks on paper, unfortunately.
I'll jump in. So, Mike, you've accused us of wanting a polite debating club, and your question sounded like you were saying, where's the polite debating club? Maybe it wasn't that, that wasn't what you were getting at. But what I would say is, like, what's the next step? What's the discussion? It could be a play I write. It could be a stand-up comedy show I put on. It could be an X post. It could be anything. I think the American Revolution was started with pamphlets. It's often there isn't a level playing field either. It's not necessarily revolutionary. It's evolutionary. Could take 30 years. I've been talking to some Iranian activists who are very much against the regime. They feel very talked over at the moment, and they often do. And I feel their frustration. It just may take a lot more time for them, you know? It's not always fair. The marketplace is not always fair. Markets aren't always fair. I may have a great product. You might not want to buy it yet. That might be worth a lot of money in 20 years' time. You know, it's one of those situations. I think the harm one I'd like to address as well, because I find there's a bit of irony in the whole concept of this harm. It's very nebulous. It's very hard to sort of establish what this harm is necessarily. And the other thing is that harm is different for different people. I know there was a research done in Australia with Indigenous Australian children, and they reported feeling proud of themselves and stronger when they stood up to racism. So they viewed it as an opportunity to grow resilience within themselves. They liked the feeling. And I remember a podcast I did quite a while back where I was speaking to a gentleman from the Congo. And we were talking about racists, and we both agreed that we sort of feel pity for them. We don't really feel, sometimes there's anger, but often there's pity. We're human beings. We have complex sort of views on this stuff. I'll be very brazen here. You know, sometimes I appreciate a racist because I know where I stand if they're out there with their speech. It's the people who sort of, you know, I've got a sense that something's going on, but they're not being transparent about it. They're the ones that frustrate me because they're the ones that normalize racism, which takes me to the other point. What is the most damaging statement you can give to a Jew? It's going to be different for every person you speak to, every Jew you speak to. If you go around a room and ask, which makes it hard to legislate and decide on these harms objectively, Israel is an apartheid state. That to me is the worst thing you can possibly say. Now, if a neo-Nazi on X jumps on my account and says the worst things, Hitler should have finished you off, all that kind of stuff, I'm inclined to roll my eyes at that guy. I'll block him or whatever I'll do, but I don't think he's getting too many converts. This is a level a lot of people probably imagine would be where the hate speech laws and things like that would sit. But I don't think he's getting many converts. Israel as an apartheid state is not true. It's not factual. We pretty much know where it comes from. The concept was an old Soviet propaganda thing that was put out years ago. But it's normalized. Everyone can say it. The Green Party will say it all the time. We've got people in power saying it. So many people say it. Now, what does this statement achieve? It says that if you support the continuation of Israel in its current form, you are as loathsome as a supporter of apartheid-era South Africa. Now, this has been going on for 30 years. No hate speech law is going to hoover this up. all the people that want hate speech laws today would throw their toys out of the cot if anyone proposed to ban that, and they'd try to stop it. But it's one of the more dehumanizing things you can say. So harm, how do you measure it? No, that's not going to be on the radar for a lot of people, that one. It's just going to be legitimate political speech. That's the way they're going to view it, you know? And again, sometimes the more strident the racist is, ironically, the less they harm an adult who's being mature about it and understanding, well, this is just a crank and I can just move on quite quickly. Are they getting converts?
I don't think people at the extreme end really are.
You mentioned thinking about it as a debating society, and I don't think we can approach it as a debating society. I think that's one of the issues that we have, that we think we can just rationally, coolly sit back and debate these things. Well, maybe Parliament can, but we know Parliament doesn't operate in that way either. Maybe legislation can work in that way in its development, but its application. We've just seen the death of Habermas, and Habermas did a lot of work on the public sphere, the public square, that you could actually come in we should come in and rationally debate things and put them together. But as a lot of critique, Bruno Latour and others said, well, the Habermasian club where you can come and hang your coat of difference at the door and just sit there and pontificate around and do it, well, that's not where flesh and blood real people exist. And I think that's the question of free speech, that the idea of it is that we will undertake it rationally and we will respond to it rationally and we'll respond to it in a particular way. But I think your point, Dane, is a good one. We respond from our own positions. We respond from our own context. And that means having to hear stuff that you don't want to hear. It's how we respond to it. And I always think if I want to stop someone saying something I don't like, then I've got to allow them to stop me from saying something they don't like. That's where I'm talking about reciprocity there. But we don't really want to go down that line because we tend to say, well, I know what's true, I know what's good, and I have the right to say this, but you are wrong, therefore you don't have the right to say that. And we actually moralise free speech. And that's one of the challenges we've got, whereas the law allows far more free speech than people often wish to participate in or actually enable between themselves or between them and other people. How do you get the law back into the discussion? The freedom that the law offers, I'd suggest, is actually much larger than the freedom that often everyday interaction offers.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And especially for whatever reason, these days, people seem really keen to censor offensive speech. And of course, to a lawyer or anyone voiced in sort of free speech theory and so on, we don't have a right not to be offended, but we have a right to speak against offensive speech. And we also have a right to make offensive speech ourselves. The law just doesn't want to be involved, and I would argue shouldn't be involved. And we've got to somehow work out that point that Dane was talking about, where, you know, where do we decide it's stop being just offensive and become harm, real harm? And that's a case-by-case thing, Dane, I'm sorry. And it is difficult. I think you both just agreed with my statement that this is really complex and difficult. And it's not as easy as people often think, oh, let's pass a law against it. Let's just ban that. Let's just ban people saying that offensive stuff. And, you know, I'm really upset about this. People shouldn't be able to say that sort of thing. And that's just not the same as exercising free speech. It's cutting free speech off before it even starts to work in the way that it should. But what worries me these days is that, and Dane, you actually used the word marketplace, this marketplace of ideas where we're all meant to be together talking, not just having a nice, you know, a mild debate or whatever, but yeah, saying offensive things, strong things and so on. And we don't like that, but and hopefully people are more civilised and we can get ideas across a bit better if people are civilised and not polarised, which seems to be the trend these days. But as I say, we have younger generations now. I've tried to explain freedom of expression theory to my daughters, for example, who are in their 20s, and they're still keen to censor speech where they're offended by it. And I've tried to explain the distinction between a speech that is just offensive as opposed to speech that really harms. It's a really tricky thing to do, but the way the law is, and we've had plenty of case law about this, you know, people, racism is a good example. One of the important New Zealand cases involved cartoons published in a newspaper of talking about the food in schools program and implying that brown people, you know, were using this program a lot of the time. We have got very limited race-based legislation in the Human Rights Act. Is very limited as to when that can be prescribed. But anyway, it went all the way to the High Court. And the High Court in the end said this is offensive and we all know what it's saying and so on, but it doesn't actually do what the wording and the law required, which was to be serious, incite in a way feelings against particular groups in society. And so the court said this wasn't serious enough, the cartoons weren't serious enough, and that where you're prescribing speech in that way, it's only the really serious harmful speech that should be limited by the law and should restrict freedom of expression generally. So it's a balance, and it's hard balancing. It's what we do in the law in New Zealand and then in the UK, in fact, in Canada. We balance the rights of people rather than saying someone's right and someone's wrong. We balance and try and work out, you know, which should be given the most weight in a given circumstance. So it's very contextual as well. And so it's very hard to draw out of that this one easy statement about what is hate speech, for example. I mean, hate speech is a form of speech. I don't know what hate speech is. The government's given up trying to work out what hate speech is. They've reviewed this area of the law or packed it off to the Law Commission, various other places to be reviewed in different governments, not only the government we've got now, Labour as well. And they realise each time they do this that it's really, really hard to try and work out what hate speech is in order to be able to restrict it. So at the moment, you know, it's kind of reached the end of the line with the Law Commission being asked some time ago not to look at hate speech, but to look at hate crimes and try and sort of prescribe those in some way that will make groups like Muslims and so on following the terrorist attack and all of that feel better. And there just is no easy answer. The attempts to define hate speech that I've seen in legislation and in suggested, you know, reform documents and so on are laughable, a lot of them, and they're all different.
I think your cartoon example is a really good one because it's raising a whole lot of things that are coming up. We just had the death of Garrick Tremaine, someone who actually took the mickey out of everyone. He felt he should be able to critique anyone, and that was always the position. But he got cancelled in the name, it was seen as too offensive. Al Nisbet is the other one, and Al Nisbet's found a home on The Good Oil with Cam Slater. And some of his cartoons are very close to the bar, but he's got a really good, insightful pulse into what is happening. But the other one is interesting with hate speech now is the return of blasphemy laws. And I think this is really, really problematic that's coming in. And it was actually, I don't know, many people don't know this, it was actually Capping Mags at Massey in Auckland that drove the charge against blasphemy laws in this country. And that's actually where the blasphemy laws got overturned. One of the interesting things is if I want to critique someone's religious belief, is that hate speech? I teach on religion. That's the whole history of religion anyway. I mean, that you are criticising other people's beliefs and even those within your own group. If we're going to bring back blasphemy laws, then we're in a really problematic area in regard, I would suggest, to free speech in this country, because we are going to see people prosecuted for saying things that really should be free, to be able to be expressed in a free country. You don't have to agree with someone, but you should be able to articulate why you don't agree. And I think that's a really important point.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you talk about blasphemy because I'm not aware of a move in New Zealand to bring it back. We've actually only just got it off the books reasonably recently, although it was a dead letter. But in the UK, certainly, I think it's really concerning what's happened over there. And those laws are completely unworkable. You don't achieve anything by bringing those in. I totally agree with you.
I'm picking up moves of people who want to bring back laws that say you can't criticise people's beliefs.
Yeah.
And the next stage of that becomes blasphemy laws that you're not...
Right. Yep, fair enough.
And in a country with no state religion,
Yeah.
On the cartoon and incitement, what I find interesting about that is that was the cartoon inciting, or was did it have potential to incite, or was it articulating something people were feeling? I think sometimes we get the stuff around the wrong way. I'm not saying just because they feel it, it's true. That's not what I'm saying. Just so that's very, very clear to people listening and on the panel. But I do wonder if this, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong here, Michael, but, you know, in terms of that whole constructivist idea that we're sponges and easily influenced, and I think it's quite ideological, a lot of this stuff, that, oh, you know, they're going to see this, they're going to, you know, be influenced. I mean, a good example of that is sex in schools. I know, you know, with the Free Speech Union, some people are quite concerned about how far sex in schools goes. And I discovered that my son was a part of some of these classes, and I hadn't been informed by the school. And I said, well, what's going on? You know, what happens in these classes? I'm quite curious, you know, is what I'm hearing hyperbolic and you know what I mean? Or is it all true? And he said, oh, we think it's all really silly and we just joke about it. And then I thought, well, okay, religion in schools. It's not like we all walked out of that evangelical Christians. I mean, often it was the time where we, as young people, would poke holes in these theories and things like, theories don't go well with kids. Theories don't tend to go well with kids. I have more faith in people and even our children, to be honest with you. Yeah. The other thing with hate speech laws, if you look at, say, the UK, for instance, and I think this is a bit of an elephant in the room. We don't really have many laws on the books. Well, a better way to probably put it is we don't really have a culture of arrest for this stuff. That would probably be the better way to put it. It's not that they're not on the books, but we don't really have a culture of going after people and arresting them with the laws that we have. In the UK, clearly they do. In Australia, they have way more oppressive laws than I would have really thought that they would have ever got to. I just wouldn't have expected them to go the way they've gone. Now, hate speech laws clearly haven't worked in the UK because they've got incredible divisions. I don't think they're working in Australia either, and I think you're seeing open defiance of some of these laws now, anti-Israel protesters, pro-Palestinian protesters and everything. You know, I'm a Zionist and pro-Israel, but I applaud them because they should be able to articulate their messaging and say what they want to say. They don't work. They don't work. I think we need to be honest about that. And going back to the cartoon idea, I don't think the English lawmakers are concerned it will lead to more radicalization. I think they're seeing radicalization. They're not great leaders. I don't think we're living through an era of fantastic, inspired leaders. These are technocrats who think that I'll put lids on all these things. They exist now. No one needs to be radicalized. I've radicalized them. I'm the boss. I'm the leader. I'm the one that starts the damage ultimately. I don't want to accept that. So let's just put all these lids on these things. So like the cartoon example, these divisions exist. All these laws are doing is criminalizing them to make the leader look like they've got control of the situation, which they do not. But would you swap our race relations for Australia's? I wouldn't. You know, just looking at X and looking at all these other, that we're still in a way better place comparatively than any of these other countries. And yet we don't really have many of these laws or the ones that we do. We don't have the culture of arrest associated with them. So that's what I would say.
I'm inclined to agree with you about the culture of arrest and so on. UK, they've also got legislation now that has allowed the police to, you know, knock on someone's door, scare them hugely, like Graham Linehan, for example, and cause him to have to spend a lot of money defending himself and, you know, almost go bankrupt and all of that, but not actually charge them with anything, but put their name on a secret list back at the station of people who, although they didn't actually break the law, they did say something pretty hateful, and so next time, you know, you'll be able to swoop in there, that this is against all the correct constitutional principles around lawmaking. And thank God some people are now challenging that in terms of human rights, the fact that the police, you know, would keep these secret lists of people who haven't actually broken the law and you know, look to use it in the future to try and either make those people appear to be criminal or argue that, you know, they've got a propensity that justifies similar behaviour from the police later. So we mustn't let that happen. And this is something that can happen if you bring in hate speech offences, and it shouldn't be left with the police to have discretions of that sort. They've got to be appropriately trained so that they know how to use these laws properly and do some appropriate weighing. Otherwise, they should be subject to appeal or review or whatever. I'm against hate speech offences, like possibly not for the same reasons, but I don't think they work. They're not workable.
Chris Farfoy, he had a rough time. I don't think he wanted to revisit this. I have engaged with Andrew Little on it and Kitty Allen. They were both really good about it, actually, because it's and I felt a little guilty because, you know, part of the free speech union, we thought we were in this ding-dong battle with them. But, you know, after seeing the Australians push very complex laws through in 3 days, it's like Andrew Little held on to this issue for like over a year, and then Kitty Allen at least 6 months or 8 months, and they were both really thoughtful about it. Andrew Little did say they were getting pressure before the atrocity. This was something that had been in the pipeline for a while. The Human Rights Commission had wanted it in as far back as 2017, I believe, and he felt pressure but just couldn't find the line. He just wasn't confident where that line was. Kitty Allen too said that, you know, the first thing she did was say, okay, go out and find me where they've worked. And nothing came back that was that compelling to her. So I applaud them, actually. Like, I thought they were very thoughtful and they both considered it deeply. And it was interesting because they didn't come to a place where they thought they could make it work, but they did, when in speaking with me, sound like they still sort of agreed in principle. And I didn't push them on it, but I was a bit like, well, do they work or don't they? There's a little bit of that, but I still applaud them because what we saw in Australia is just a travesty. I mean, laws like this being pushed through that quickly is just, I don't think people really understand the magnitude of the insanity. I don't believe that would ever happen here or could happen here. But it's interesting as to why, and I do want to actually engage with a lot more lawyers in Australia, you know, just to get that example and put it out there to our supporters, because I think the fact that went through so quickly and everything has just been just a, you know, gasoline on a already raging fire over there. I don't think it's been helpful at all. I mean, you cannot convince a public that something that's been pushed through this quickly has been thought through.
Is it a type of populism, a different type of populism that you have? So these things you push through under haste, under urgency, they're anti-democratic in that way. But it's part of another side of the populism, the post-democratic push that we're seeing across. And the problem with free speech is as we said, it's intensely democratic. When people want to speak against free speech, I always think, oh, here's someone who wants to move against other people's chance to speak. Is a wonderful line by P.J. O'Rourke from years ago, and it was something like, inside every liberal, there's a little Mussolini saying, I know what's best for you. And I think there is that sense when the liberal wishes to limit the speech of others, they are saying that I know what's best for you, and especially when the technocrat liberal is there. Because the technocrat believes they know what is best because they've got the system. I'm speaking here as someone who would say they are a liberal, but I'm a liberal against many liberals because I think many liberals are actually technocrats, or many liberals wish to don't actually want to be liberal. They want to be illiberal against those who they don't agree with. Mm. The worst example of hate speech that I ever saw in a cartoon, what we could call hate speech, was actually cartoons about John Key. And what was really interesting about the cartoons about John Key is they drew very heavily on the Nazi era stereotypes of the Jew
And here's John Key in the mainstream papers, especially in The Listener. Trace Hodgson was one of the ones with this huge hook nose, but also the vampire teeth. They were just purely anti-Semitic hatred on one level. Yeah. Now, if anyone wanted to bring a case, that would have been, you could have actually traced it all the way back to, well, this is actually what is happening here. John Key is being represented along hate lines that were, we can see a direct linkage here going back into anti-Semitic cartoons that were flowing in Nazi Germany. Now, Nobody wanted to make that connection until I pointed it out when I gave the talk on it in National Library, which was sort of, and that sort of threw like a dead cat amongst the pigeons in that way. And it was like, oh my God, so what are you doing critiquing that? I said, well, this is what we've got to deal with. But on the other hand, it's important to know that that sort of trope, that sort of thinking is actually circulating around in our community.
Mm-hmm.
The free speech that enabled that cartoon to be published also makes people aware of what is actually out there. And I think your point, Dane, about if it's not there, then it gets hidden.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually far more problematic. Put it in the cold light of day, and then we get to see things.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing I would say about a lot of this stuff is we talk about the culture war, right? A lot of this is framed in that you know term that it's the culture war, but we should be having an economic war. Now, my old lefty's got to come out. There are young people today that will never own a home. The way we're going, where are the high-paying jobs for unskilled workers? Where are all these things? So I do think that, you know, I've used this guy a bit and he's becoming a character and I'm going to keep using him. But I have this character I've created, the Takanini Tire Changer. So he's from Takanini up in South Auckland. He changes tires. That's his job, right? He's never invited to meetings at the BSA to decide whether this should be banned or not. He's not going to be consulted on hate speech laws or any of these laws. There is a certain type of person that's going to be a part of that group, and they're going to be the ones that decide. But it won't be a person like that. It won't be someone from some of these neighborhoods. And I think that's a real big issue. So it's very much an affluent class that are behind a lot of these censorship projects. And I do worry that we are potentially silencing people or getting mechanisms in place because there are wider societal issues that certain groups just do not want to have to deal with. Now, that's going to sound really conspiratorial, but we know that a lot of young people are never going to get into homes. Life is going to get a lot tougher economically for people. And none of these managers we have been able to do anything about it. I mean, we're at a point now where we shouldn't probably get too political, but, you know, I knew Jacinda Ardern personally, really liked her personally, did not change, did not deliver when it came to a lot of social things and that, still considered great. So she wasn't being judged on economics or anything like that. She was being judged on something different. So there's a class that were comfortable enough that they could judge her on that. They had the liberty and the luxury to judge her on that. But what about all the people at the bottom? So I do worry that this illiberal turn, it's not being driven by people that are on the lower rungs. It never is. Coming from South Auckland, hate speech laws never would have reached there anyway. And these are the most multicultural areas in the country. Because there's so many different aspects where people are exploring censorship and people are very keen, but I do worry that it's a distraction from the core issues of governance that aren't really being addressed or sorted out in our country.
I think we're all kind of committed to this idea of the marketplace of ideas, that basic liberal approach. But the question I ask these days, and I ask myself, and I don't know the answer yet, is that marketplace working? Is the theory at risk because the marketplace is no longer working? And you can imagine what I'm going to say is talk about how, you know, this idea of all forms of expression going together, truth and untruth, and the truth emerges after the discussion, the sorts of discussions we've been talking about based on, you know, both parties all parties tolerating and listening to the views of others and talking and so on. Is it still working in the new technological age that we've got, where there's plenty of misinformation, disinformation and malinformation out online, which is where an awful lot of this discussion goes on these days? And so can the truth still emerge? Can it? Can we just leave it to this old theory? What do you think?
The first thing is that I don't think the marketplace of ideas is working offline. I mean, you and I work in the university. We've been to university. I mean, conscience and critics speak truth to power, apart from within our own meetings and within our own faculties and within our academic board. I mean, we don't do that. And so very few people are prepared to speak up publicly. Offline, is it easier to do that online? Because then there's an impersonality there. There's separation. If we think about what's happening online, I mean, we've got to think, well, what is the whole mantra that drove Facebook? It was move fast and break things. I mean, what is being broken is actually society. What is being broken is trust. What is being broken is a sense of reciprocity. But then if you ask young people who spend a lot of time online, how do you feel when you come off it? They feel like crap. And that's really interesting. What you've got, if we're going to talk about the online, then we've got to talk about, well, what society system do we have that is creating an addiction to feeling like shit? And it goes back to Dane's question about economics. I mean, the whole point of it is actually to get your data so they can sell it to advertisers. And so the more controversy that you can create, the more participation, therefore the more data that you're actually gathering from online. And so this is where we have to unpack it in that sort of critical way. Can you regulate it? Well, how do you stop someone going online? I mean, it's a bit like saying under 16 should not be, well, everybody knows they're online. I mean, they're there because how do you actually prove that?
I think that's a trite argument and I don't accept it. I think you're partly right, but I don't believe it's a reason not to have a go. And so I am inclined to support these moves in Australia and the UK. And I think possibly the government will follow through here, because I think there will be popular support for that, to keep under 16s off, as you say, an addictive area of life.
Can you retrofit it though? I mean, it's too late in many ways.
Well, I think a lot of parents want it. I think you're rejecting the reform before it's even had a, you know, I think those sorts of arguments are specious and I think they're overstated as well. Sure, kids will push back and sure, some of them will be upset and so on. I think the stronger arguments are where kids might argue they've got rights of some kind and that they're having those restricted in a way that's unacceptable. That's a different and I think a more powerful argument. But just saying the kids are always going to go online and, you know, find a way around this and blah, blah, blah. Some of them will, of course, that's always happened. I personally believe that law has a strong symbolic effect, even if there are attempts to undermine it. Parents will be aided by being able to say to their kids, you're not allowed actually to be on social media. Of course, there will be some who are ignoring that and breaking the law and so on, but I don't think that's enough of a reason to say this is not going to work, because we don't know. And I think with a reasonable proportion of young people, it will work and then it will become normalised. You know, we didn't used to be required to wear safety belts. Now, these days, I think people would be frowned on for refusing to wear them and so on. And the law changed that. That was how we did it. Laws are never totally 100% effective. These arguments about it'll never work, I just think that people don't know. They don't know.
Could I jump in on the under 16s? Because I oppose it. I spoke to a very interesting PhD candidate on a podcast that we did recently, the Free to Speak podcast, New Zealand Free Speech Union podcast. And he was sort of an anthropology, would look at young people, the way they, you know, study tribes in Africa and all that kind of stuff, to see the way children develop in the West and they develop in tribal situations, all that kind of stuff. His concern was that he didn't believe any of the evidence was compelling, that there were real harms even on social media, and that Jonathan Haidt, and this is about the marketplace of ideas, another point I wanted to make, not all of us are wildly charismatic. Some of us are. Not all of us are wildly charismatic. So you know what I mean?
We're not be yourself.
So he's Jonathan Haidt can do the TED talk, but someone with more compelling academic evidence just might fizz in that place. I mean, an analogy I have is like a man can walk up to a woman in a bar and give her a line and have a drink. Another man can say the same line and be escorted out of the bar by the security. There's just an energy that comes with this stuff. And, a few would-be messiahs have to fall before one rises up and does compel people with their argument. You know what I mean? It doesn't mean that they had more knowledge necessarily. It's just the way they were able to articulate it. The evidence, he would say, is not really compelling. What they're doing is they're looking at screen time, which could be social media. It could be Wikipedia learning about the grazing cycle of zebras. And this is the other thing with censorship. So many babies potentially get thrown out with the bathwater here. That is a real concern. The other thing, like when you say that, Ursula, that laws can be symbolic, and that's a good thing. Like when I was younger, a law like that was a wager to me. You can't watch Clockwork Orange because it's R20. Okay, you wait. We had to work for it. We had to risk the belt. Kids today don't. And I think, if they have to work for it, then okay, I applaud you. I think it's a rite of passage to want to defy authority.
Some people think that way. Some people quite like rules and regulations. They regulate their lives.
Well, but is that the person that's going to sort of get into a dangerous situation online? Like maybe not so much. I mean, my children were brought up pretty isolated from the wider Jewish community. So social media and things like that to be connected to their cultural community was really important. What are we doing about that? Oh, we're not considering it. You know, there's just so many aspects to this that people aren't considering. There's this idea that people go online, like you suggest, Mike, and then become depressed or come off not feeling good. But it's not really conclusive whether they go on depressed. Is depression leading them to social media, or is social media depressing them? It's not clear.
Question about what they're actually accessing when they're on there. You could use social media in different ways. I mean, Substack's an interesting thing. I mean, you can spend time reading Substacks, and you could come off that being depressed, or you could come off that feeling more positive. I mean, there's a great book on the history of sociology called Enlightenment and Despair. A number of my students come out of my classes going, oh, God, I feel crap about this. That is part of it. We've got to say, well,
sometimes you should feel like crap.
Yeah, and then start to think, well, why do you feel like crap? And I think that is part of the question about how we deal with the wider context. I mean, the interesting thing is we've actually segued out of free speech into societal conditions, into the question of, well, media technology, censorship we haven't even touched yet, but that's an interesting side of that over there. And then should you censor music? That was the next one that comes through. And that is the question, therefore, of harm. We come back to what Ursula was talking about. Well, how do you define harm? And you've talked about that too, Dane. What is harm? And this is the issue. What one person thinks is harm, another person will actually think, well, that's actually just freedom, that's liberty, that's opinion. So how do you prove harm? Well, in many ways, prove harm is when someone acts upon what is articulated.
That incitement level you're talking about, Mike. Yeah. Like it would have to get to a real world consequence that had been sort of pushed by the speech. No, but that's right. It's like some of us are wallflowers, some of us are not. Some of us like to go after racists actually and track them down and have a crack at them. The idea of harms is very person to person, which makes it tough to sort of create laws around, I guess. Harms, level of hurt people are going to feel, are going to be very much, they're individualistic to people, aren't they? I mean, it's all going to be different. There are things I could say to you that could really break you. There are things that you could say the same thing back to me and it won't, or vice versa. It feels to me way too hard to do. Way too hard to do, and for what gain? Like, that's the other thing we need to think about. We can wrestle with this and come up with something that's good enough, but is it just going to entrench divisions, throw walls up between people so they feel like they're walking on eggshells around each other? You know, we talk about trade-offs. What about the trade-off there? Is it worth what we risk? And I don't think that comes into the debate enough.
You were implying it's impossible to draw lines, but the law does draw lines, and it does draw it successfully. We're all pretty much agreed on what the most abhorrent things are that we don't want spoken or depicted or shown. And the one example I can give of that is child pornography. I think we can generally say with a reasonable amount of certainty that most people in society would agree that that's the sort of thing that should be censored and shouldn't be regarded as speech, even, is one way of looking at it. So you can draw lines, but the problem with hate speech and all the things we've been talking about today, we're not talking about those sorts of very clear categories, I think. And we live in this society that has a plurality of views and cultures and religions, and so much more so than it ever used to be. There is no one right way to live the best life anymore. I personally have altered my view of freedom of expression, and I am prepared now, because of the changes in technology and what it is doing to the disappearance of truth in terms of discourse, I'm prepared to look at ways of encouraging truth to survive, basically. And if that includes regulating internet service providers, companies that are sending information into all societies now, then I think we need to look at that and be brave about it while still remembering and paying relevant weight to this really important principle of freedom of expression.
Thank you, Ursula, Mike and Dane. This has been such a massive, massive discussion. It's really ranged a lot. I don't even think I've asked a question. It's been incredibly enlightening. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Sally. Thanks for the opportunity. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Dane.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Great discussion.
Yeah.